How much has America changed in the last 60 years? Immensely in many ways, and hardly at all in others. That's one lesson to be drawn from the new book, You Have to Be Prepared to Die Before You Can Begin to Live, 10 Weeks in Birmingham That Changed America, by Paul Kix. Paul is an author whose writing has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, GQ, and other publications. And in his new book, he tells the riveting story of one of the most pivotal campaigns of the civil rights movement, the 1963 effort by the Southern Christian Leadership Conference to end segregation in Birmingham, Alabama. Here he is to share five key insights from the book.
Hi, I'm Paul Kix. I'm a journalist who's written for lots of magazines, The New Yorker, The Atlantic, GQ, and the author, most recently, of You Have to Be Prepared to Die Before You Can Begin to Live. It's a book of narrative nonfiction and memoir that goes deep on the 10 most critical weeks in American history. The Birmingham campaign in Birmingham, Alabama, when the Southern Christian Leadership Conference descended on the city in the spring of 1963 to either break segregation once and for all or be broken by it. The Birmingham campaign, or as Martin Luther King Jr. and his deputies called it, Project Confrontation, it altered the trajectory of the United States and put in motion everything that followed. Not just the Civil Rights Act of 1964, not just the Voting Rights Act of 1965, but King's martyrdom in 1968, and then a new life for his country, right down to me marrying a black woman in a former Jim Crow state and raising our three black kids on a shaded street today, where no one harasses us for who we are. 60 years after Project Confrontation, I owe my life and livelihood to that campaign's success. I'm honored to share five big takeaways from what happened 60 years ago this spring, takeaways that were just as applicable back then as they are to my life and yours, takeaways about how to endure and even thrive amid seemingly unendurable situations. Number one, lean into your vulnerability. So let's start with where this SCLC was back then. They were broke. They were ridiculed by other civil rights groups as pompous and weak. They had just staged a year-long campaign in Albany, Georgia, and lost, which the press, Southern and Northern, called the most humiliating defeat of King's career. By the early months of 1963, King's SCLC had not won a single civil rights campaign since its founding 7 years prior. And against that backdrop, Wyatt Walker, the executive director of the SCLC, said, "All our flaws can be turned into strengths if we look for the lessons in each." Walker spent months analyzing the SCLC's vulnerabilities and weaknesses and found that the organization wasn't really vulnerable or weak. The SCLC had just made a couple bad assumptions in the past. The first was that it had always staged campaigns in conjunction with other civil rights groups. The second was that these campaigns had been waged in places where the groups thought they might win. In the months prior to Project Confrontation's debut, Walker wrote a blueprint for how it should proceed. Number one, the SCLC should be the only group overseeing this campaign, Walker wrote. And number two, they should stage it not where they might win, but where they were assured to suffer. Because if they and their volunteers suffered violence, suffered mightily, it would get to the conscience of white America and the Kennedy brothers who governed it in ways that no campaign had in the past. And that's how the SCLC settled on the most violent, most racist city for Project Confrontation, Birmingham, Alabama. Walker's insights astounded everyone within the SCLC, and the only reason he developed these insights was that he had the temerity to look where others hadn't, deep into the past and deep into the SCLC's own humiliations and weaknesses. By looking at the SCLC's vulnerabilities, Wyatt Walker also found the best place to stage the organization's largest campaign. To paraphrase what Walker would later say himself, look into your own vulnerabilities and you will find a reservoir of untapped strength. The second big takeaway is this: courage is not mandatory in life. Look, Birmingham in those days wasn't so much a city as a site of domestic terror. The Klan castrated black men. The cops raped black women. The city's public safety commissioner, Bull Connor, gleefully and often publicly referred to Birmingham as Bombingham, for all the black businesses and residences that were dynamited. CBS's Edward R. Murrow reported from Birmingham prior to King's arrival and told his producer he hadn't seen anything like this place since Nazi Germany. All of this is why King thought he and or his deputies would die for going down there. So how did they do it? What sort of pep talks did they give themselves? What sort of courage did they display? Well, the real courage they showed was to admit how they weren't courageous at all. King delivered a mock eulogy before the SCLC left for Birmingham. It was a way to acknowledge the obvious. They were all terrified of campaigning down there. And it was also a way to ease the tension that lived within that fear, deflate it until it became a joke. The eulogy turned into very dark, very black humor. It worked, though. To show each other that they all had fear was a way to buoy themselves that they could all withstand it, too. They prayed about their fear, and then they found something greater than it, greater even than courage, too. Action. The best elixir for fear is action, King later wrote. For King and the leaders of the SCLC, that meant arriving in Birmingham and just starting the campaign, just putting in the effort day after day, before they were ready, before they were courageous. It was never not terrifying, but because the SCLC was in the midst of responding to it, the terror wasn't overwhelming either. Action decreases fear. Keep that in mind. It's true in all of life's encounters. Number three, your grand plan is never the final plan. Adapt. It didn't matter that Wyatt Walker had promises from over 300 volunteers and an association of Black Baptist ministers. Hardly any of those volunteers stepped forward once the SCLC arrived in Birmingham. And the massive association of ministers? They turned frosty to King and Walker, colder than December in Boston, the city where King had obtained his PhD, King later wrote. The reasons why are too numerous to get into here, but the upshot is this. The SCLC started the largest campaign of its life with the fewest number of volunteers it had ever assembled. It had to find a way to adapt fast. That's when the SCLC's James Bevel, its operations lead and a man far younger than the middle-aged King, and one who favored overalls instead of the standard movement-issued conservative suit, James Bevel told King the campaign would work only if children let it. Their parents, you see, might get fired for protesting, but kids didn't hold jobs and only wanted a future better than their decrepit present, where they got discarded sporting equipment and school textbooks that were a generation at least out of date. King did not want to use children against the brutality of Bull Connor's cops and Bull's friends in the Klan, but the campaign turned anemic with only adults leading it. And meanwhile, Bevel was training kids by the dozens, the hundreds, and then thousands in the means of nonviolent protest. Bevel realized something key to the problem of the Birmingham campaign, which is also any problem in life. The best plan is the one where you are constantly adapting to the circumstances around you, looking for the best solution. Number four, suffering is eternal, victimhood is optional. In early May 1963, Bevel led a campaign within the Birmingham campaign, which he called D-Day. It was thousands of children skipping school on May 2nd and 3rd and descending on Kelly Ingram Park, across from the 16th Street Baptist Church. The objective was to get to the white-owned and white-run downtown and stage massive protests for civil rights there. But on May 2nd and 3rd, Bull Connor and the Birmingham Police Department stood in the way, with guns and German shepherds and even fire hoses that could tear mortar from bricks or dislodge bark from trees at a distance of 100 feet. Bevel had children march right into those guns and dogs and fire hoses anyway. The result was savage, apocalyptic, the worst thing war photographers present that day had ever seen, they later said. Children mauled by dogs as if the dogs were feasting on them. Children backflipped in the air from the fire hoses, their clothes just kind of disintegrating on their bodies. Their hair scalped, effectively, as the fire hoses hissed across their skulls. The children knew this might happen. Bevel had prepared them for it. And because they had known they would likely suffer, they did not turn their suffering into victimhood. They did not stop marching. They never really complained. By the dozens and then hundreds and ultimately thousands, the children continued to march in early May. As a result, they could not be stopped. As a result, Birmingham began to desegregate. When you know that everyone in life will suffer in some way, you realize that your own suffering can serve a cause. At minimum, it is a way to forge you into a better person. At most, it is the means to change the world. Number 5, control what is in your control and then watch your sphere of influence grow. The attacks grew more vicious. The hotel where the SCLC stayed was bombed. The home of King's brother AD was bombed. But by mid-May 1963, the SCLC saw these attacks for what they were: desperate attempts by racist whites to remain in control of the city. But white authority could no longer control anything so long as the SCLC realized what was within its control: the ability to stay calm in the face of such attacks, the ability to go to the press and say that the volunteers and SCLC itself would remain peaceful regardless of what happened to them, which began to engender the support of the nation to the cause of the SCLC. King's group and its volunteers controlled what was within their purview, their words and actions. And by controlling that, by never stooping to white authorities' tactics, by showing the press over and over the brutality of how whites treated blacks in Birmingham, which soon became a metaphor for how whites treated blacks in America, the Kennedy administration pressured white civic leaders to sign a document desegregating Birmingham, the most racist city in America. As a result of that desegregation pact, other American cities, well beyond Birmingham and inspired by what happened there, began to stage their own protest. Suddenly, there were 50 Birminghams, 100 Birminghams all over the nation, and the Kennedy brothers realized the only way to find solutions for them all was to do the one thing they had been loath to do: author civil rights legislation. Because that might mean the end of Jack Kennedy's reelection bid. So said Kennedy's own pollsters. But Bobby Kennedy became convinced, with King now advising him, that real and lasting civil rights legislation, which hadn't been authored by any president since emancipation 100 years earlier, was what was needed now. And so on June 11th, King got his wish. Jack Kennedy went on national television and said the time had come for the white man to see the black man as his equal. That day set in motion the Civil Rights Act that followed in the spring of 1964. And that day, decades later, allowed me to marry my wife in a former Jim Crow state and allowed us to raise our black kids on that quiet street and not be harassed for it. The spring of 1963 altered America in ways that no season had before and no season has since. My book is a narrative of that spring, but really a guide for how to live with courage and dignity and righteousness, and perhaps the greatest lesson from that spring: the ability to control what is within your control. Do that well. Do that for an extended period of time, and then watch your sphere of influence grow well beyond you.
Thank you, Paul. That was Paul Kicks with 5 big ideas from You Have to Be Prepared to Die Before You Can Begin to Live: 10 Weeks in Birmingham That Changed America. I'm Michael Kovnat. Thanks for listening.